You are listening to Badass in Heels, a podcast for everyone who's ever wondered what it's like to be a woman in the FBI. And now your host, retired supervisory special agent, Nancy Aguilar.
Welcome to Badass in Heels. This is Nancy, and you're listening to episode number 21. This episode kicks off season 3, Badass in Blue, which will highlight police women across the nation. Joining me today is retired Chief of Police, Kristen Seaman. Kristen will share her personal and professional story with us, from challenges to tremendous accomplishments, such as breaking the glass ceiling and becoming the first female chief of police in Illinois' second largest city. Kristen left a footprint in her department by positively impacting the department's culture. She is truly an inspiration to not only women in blue, but to all women in law enforcement. Kristen is the author of Reimagining Blue, in which she narrates her thoughts on life, leadership, and a new way forward in policing. I bought her book when I was a supervisor in the FBI as I was looking for strong women role models in leadership. And I never imagined that a few years later, I would get to meet her and have her on my show. I am very honored to have her today on my podcast. Kristen, thank you for joining me and being my first police woman guest and kicking off such a phenomenal season.
Thank you so much, Nancy. It is a pleasure to be here.
It is actually surreal, you know, to think I bought your book a couple of years ago, and now I'm talking to you, and you're going to tell your story. So it's just phenomenal.
I love it. You've manifested it. And also, you have the coolest podcast name in the universe.
Oh, thank you so much. So, Kristen, can we start with just talking a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, of course. I love this. This is called the origin story, right? Yeah, so I was born and raised in Aurora, Illinois. And for context, geographical context, that is about 40 miles due west of Chicago. So Aurora is the second largest city in the state of Illinois. No one knows that, but it is the home of Wayne's World. That's all I've got for pop culture. Born and raised there, my father before me was a police officer, and that is where I caught the bug. And it's interesting because a lot of people try to figure out what they want to be when they grow up. And when I was a very small child, I knew that I wanted to follow in his footsteps. It actually started when I was probably about like 8 or 10. And I was in the back seat of the station wagon, the wood paneled station wagon. And my dad was off duty and we were just driving down the street and he said, "Stay in the car, don't move." And I'm like, okay. And I watched as my dad ran over and pulled people out of a car wreck and just like laid them on the street and were tending to them. But what I noticed most about that was all of the cars that were whizzing by, and they were just looking, but they weren't helping. And the same thing happened a few years later. And I knew the drill: stay in the car, don't move. And I watched my dad wrestle keys from a drunk driver who had just plowed into a toll booth. And that's when I fully understood the role of first responders. And I thought, man, even if my dad is off duty doing this, you know, he must do, you know, amazingly heroic things while he's on duty. So I knew from that moment. And interestingly enough, I was not a very good student in school. I tried very hard to keep my transcripts from my children so they couldn't see my high school grades because I didn't care. You know, I just couldn't wait to graduate from high school and to become a police cadet, which was an intern in my police department. And so I didn't try very hard in school. And I did just that. I waited until I graduated and I took the test to become a police cadet. So at the tender age of 18, all my friends went away to college and I started at the police department. And it's interesting because it was there that they sent me to school. I had to go get my associate degree in college in criminal justice and I had to maintain a C average. And it was finally for the first time in my life that I started to love school because it was criminal justice. It was everything I was interested in. And prior to that, I was just bored, you know, and I always thought, man, I guess I'm just not that smart. But no, I was just bored. And so I went and got my associate degree in criminal justice and then became a full-fledged police officer at age 21 and then ended up going back to school to get my bachelor's degree and then going back to school again to get my master's degree and then going back to school again to get a second master's degree. So I always love to tell people this because that's what I believe poised me in my career as far as moving up the rank. And interestingly enough, I didn't do it, you know, to get rank, to promote. I just did it because I fell in love with schooling and learning about my profession. So yeah, that's the childhood. That's the origin story.
Thanks, Kristen. So, you know, of course, you mentioned your dad, and I read it on your book as well. And I can't imagine, you know, you as a young child sitting there and seeing your dad in action, right? Literally saving lives. And it's like this capeless hero. And I can't even imagine the thoughts going through, but it made such an impression on you. You know, when you reflect on it.
Yeah.
That it was just an inspiration.
Yeah, he totally was. And he would take me to the police department and he worked in evidence at a certain time in his career. And this is when they were, you know, taking photographs and they had a dark room. And so he would take photographs of murder scenes and he would show me how they, you know, the film would come out and how they would develop it in the dark room and then the fingerprint station and, you know, and how they would lift fingerprints. And I was so enamored just by the profession. So I do credit it to him for, you know, making me want to become a first responder.
That is so cool that he immersed you in his world. You know, he found the way to bring you in and show you some of the things that you could see, you know, at a tender age, right? Because we're not, you know, at that age, we're not mature enough to see everything. But that is like one of the aspects I could see the film developing as you're explaining it. And it must have been fascinating. So you mentioned, you know, your school, and it wasn't until, I guess, you found the niche, right? And you fell in love with really like, this is what I really want to study. And you focused. But then when something had a purpose, you exploited it. So in 1991, you joined as a cadet. You said you was only 17. Mm-hmm. What was that experience like?
Oh my gosh. It was both good and bad. Of course, now that I can connect the dots backwards, right? When I say all my friends went away to college and I started as a police cadet, that meant that I worked at the police department during the week and then we were allowed to go on ride-alongs on the weekend. So while all my friends in college were doing what college kids do on weekends, I was riding in squad cars. I rode 3 to 11 shift and I wouldn't even go home. The midnight shift, a new cop would come on. I would jump in with another officer. I would ride midnight shift until it slowed down. And then I would go home and go to bed and do it all over again. So it's really cool because I was immersed in the profession. I mean, baptized into it. So that's the positive part, is that I learned so much. When I look back now, I see how much negative came from that because, you know, culture. We talk about culture in law enforcement a lot, whether it be federal, state, local, you know, county, you name it, you know, reservation, all of it, university. There is a culture in all of our organizations, and a lot of that culture is positive. It's good, but there is a lot of culture that is corrosive and negative. And it was during that time, because I was such a sponge and I wanted to fit in, I wanted to be one of the guys. And so I started to emulate everyone around me. And sometimes that was emulating the wrong kind of police officer. And there were no standards of who would take the cadet for the ride along, right? Sometimes it was a good cop. Sometimes it was a cop that probably shouldn't have been teaching me. And so from the bad cops, you know, I learned to talk down to people. I learned to be like, hey, you get over here, you know, and to borrow power from my position, because that's what I thought I was supposed to do. I had no idea that there was another way. And so I picked up a lot of bad habits through that immersion. And I call it that period of my life of losing myself, losing my personality. I came from, you know, high school where I was voted, you know, I think class clown and best personality. And then I moved into policing and I was this like, you know, hey, you get over here. You know, let me see your driver's license. And I literally morphed into a person I didn't become. So mm-hmm. I learned a lot, but also I learned what not to do.
Yeah, it's, I guess, a self-realization with you because, of course, you know, those of you who have read your book and the listeners that will stay tuned till the end will learn how you changed the culture. So you went away from all the stuff guy stuff that we all saw in movies back in the 80s, right? That was it. That's we all thought as kids, that's normal. And of course, I was, of course, not in law enforcement, so I couldn't know better. I couldn't know mm-hmm. if that was efficient, if that was working with the community. And clearly, it's not. It wasn't. Yeah. And we've moved, you know, we've made tremendous headway. And of course, you did in your department, which we'll get to it later. So just amazing. And Kristen, what was it like being a cadet woman? I mean, in Aurora, mm-hmm. Because I lived in Chicago, but I can't remember if it's like considered a small town where there are a lot of women in law enforcement. What was the ratio back then?
Yeah, so we are, even though I'm retired because it's going to be my police department forever. But it's a 300 officer organization. So a mid-size agency was serving a population of about 210,000. So not a small department by any means, but not, of course, a major city, which is considered over 1,000 police officers. And at that time, we stayed with the national average. We've always been in my department about 12% female. Here's the interesting part. When I started, there were no women in rank at all, not even a sergeant. And so when you ask, what did you think when you became a police cadet, what was it like? Well, I was the only female of the six police cadets that got hired with me, but there were other women police officers. But because there were no women that had reached any kind of rank, it never occurred to me that I would be able to move up in my organization. And it's so interesting because we hear now these days that visibility matters, right? Is that you have to be able to see yourself somewhere else or the likeness, the image of yourself. And I never understood that. And so when I walked into that police department, it never occurred to me that I would ever promote to even sergeant, let alone become the police chief in my organization. And so I think that, and now, especially if I've gone through the ranks and I became the first, you know, lieutenant, it's so important to me to make sure that women and girls see possibility because you just don't see that for yourself. You don't know if you don't know.
Mm-hmm. This is such an important message. And, you know, I've never thought of that in terms of you see a woman and you want, I'm like, I can do it too, right? Mm-hmm. In leadership, yeah. You know, we talk about representation of that diversity and minority, right? You mm-hmm. want to be able to see yourself, the community to see that, mm-hmm. to see themselves in you. Yeah, I guess that's what I'm trying to say, right? Oh, she's Hispanic. So I can build rapport with her and tell her all my secrets, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, with the Black community and the whites, et cetera. But it is the same thing for women in leadership. You want to aspire to be someone like that. And, you know, you have something in your book that I loved, and I think I mentioned it to you. It was about promoting, not to promote in your image, right? Mm-hmm. You don't want another you.
That's right.
You know?
Yeah. But a lot of people do, but a lot of people promote that way.
Yeah. And it's, not probably the right thing. You don't want a little mini-me's out there. You want people that can bring different sets of skills, different sets of perspectives, you know, different goals, different objectives, different changes and affect those changes because they have a different mentality. So going back to your experience, you make it through the cadets. How rigorous is that? Or is it, I mean, do they have an academy where you actually... Mm-hmm. You know, the push-ups, pull-ups, is it military mm-hmm. stick? What was mm-hmm. it that like?
Yeah, in order to be a police cadet, at least in my department, we had to take the same test that is administered at the academy in order to get hired as a cadet. And the reason they do that is they put you through it, you know, at the department to make sure that when you get to the academy, that you can maintain that level of physical fitness. So that was not a problem for me. It never has been. I've always been pretty, you know, athletic. And so I never struggled. Like, I know that there are a lot of women do, especially when you have to do, you know, the bench press and things like that. But for me, it was not anything that was an issue. So I never really pointed that as a challenge in my career.
Mm-hmm. We were talking about, you know, women in the police force and you making it to be the first woman lieutenant. Mm-hmm. And of course, you were the first chief of police in history in the Aurora department. Why do you think it's important to have, first of all, women in law enforcement?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, my gosh. It's just like you said about, I'd love to go back what you were saying about, you know, creating people in your own image, because this is one of the lessons that I try to tell, especially men, you know, because it is very comfortable for all of us to associate with like-minded and those who look like us. You know, we gravitate, we're so tribal. And yet that's the biggest mistake that we can make. And that's been part of the problem with not allowing other people at the table, you know, and you know, my very good friend, Chief Sylvia Moyer, now undersheriff, says, you know, if you're not at the table, you're going to be on the menu. And I always thought that was so funny. But when you people, because they're so comfortable, is they'll promote people that think like them, that look like them, that they're comfortable with. And that just creates more of the same. And so it's important, I think, not just women, but diversity of thought. We do think differently because we see the world through our own lens. And that brings a whole other perspective to complex problem solving, you know, to all of it, and to even communicating. And I always hesitate to say that women are better communicators because, oh man, I learned once I stopped emulating the bad cops, I learned how to be a great communicator from the great male mentors that I had. And so I'm always hesitant about saying, you know, women are better at this and men are better at that, because I haven't found that to be the case. But what I think is so important is to have a diversity of thought and to say, wow, I think like this. Let me get somebody who would challenge my way of thinking. And a lot of times that comes, that diversity of thought also brings diversity of gender, diversity of orientation, diversity of origin, all of the things, because, you know, everyone has a different lens. So I'm a big proponent of seeking out purposely those who think differently.
Thanks, Kristen. And you say something, you mentioned communication, right? And in your book, you talk about you were chasing someone down the street, right? And I loved it. And the way you tell it is so vivid that you can't see yourself running after this guy, tackling him, right? But then he continues to run with you. But you got him to stop because you talked to him.
Yeah.
Right?
That was the pivotal moment. So there I was gathering all of the intel to be a cop, you know, during my cadet years. And then this happened when I was 3 years as a sworn officer. So by this time I had 6 years on the police department, talking down to people, borrowing power from my position. And that's the day that it all changed for me. And it's not some dramatic event where I was harmed, you know, like so many law enforcement officers have, you know, a story that's, you know, truly dramatic. This was a traffic stop where a guy took off on me on foot, and a foot pursuit. And I started chasing this guy, and the guy was huge. And every time I tell the story, he gets bigger. But I'm chasing this guy. And because I was pretty fit and I was fast, I caught up to him and I had a plan. My plan was to tackle this guy and to put him into handcuffs. And so I closed the gap, jumped on him, and he did not stumble. He did not fall. And the curious part was I continued to hang on to him and he continued to run. So if you can picture a 5'4", 120-pound baby cop on this guy's back running, you know, like a backpack, that's what it looked like. And then it was in that moment, because I didn't have a plan B, it was in that moment that I thought, oh my God, he's going to kill me. Like, this is going to end badly. We're in the backyards. I have no idea where I am. And I know help is on the way, but they can't find me. And so I say to the guy, dude, I know you could kill me. I know you can kill me, but you know, you're not going to get any street cred beating up a baby cop. And, you know, and I'm not going to get any cred with my comrades. And I'm sure it wasn't that articulate as it's coming out of my mouth now. It was more of like screaming at the guy, you know, and a curious thing happened. He just stopped. He just stopped. I slid down his back. He put his hands behind his back and I was like, okay. I grabbed my handcuffs, cuffed him up. And as I was walking with him back, you know, I said, I got to ask you, man, why did you stop? And he's like, nobody's ever just talked to me. No cop has ever just treated me, you know, with respect. And I thought, my gosh, That's it. Like, that's the secret sauce. And certainly I don't want to oversimplify it, because, you know, in our profession, there are yes people, maybe people, and no people. And there are some no people that you will not be able to talk into handcuffs. But I have found that the way you begin an interaction and the way that you talk to people really does affect the outcome. And on that day forward, I stopped using my power for my position. I stopped talking down to people and I started talking to them. And I realized that every single human being on this earth just wants to be respected and to be treated with dignity. Even if we are putting handcuffs on them, you can still treat them with dignity. And that's when I started to watch great cops do their job. And I watched them talk people into handcuffs. And I thought, this is it. And it was in that moment that that changed the whole trajectory of my career and made me a better police officer and then a better leader when I eventually became, you know, or went into a supervisory position.
Absolutely. That is one of the things we teach at the FBI Academy. Mm-hmm. Treat everybody with dignity and respect. Like those two things. Mm-hmm. Talk to people, listen, really listen. And like you said, talk to them, right? Like, have a conversation. And you're so right. There are people that don't want to hear you. But hey, at least you've tried. And that's how you're going to try. And then if you need to do something else, you do something else. But that is something. Communication was also, if I remember well, something that helped you get promoted. And I can't remember if it was you were doing an interview. And this was when I forget the name, I guess, your supervisor. I'm not sure what you call them. Wasn't directly talking to you. You were in the room, but he wasn't addressing you. And he was talking to your, was it FTO, your field training officer? Mm-hmm. And if you were able to do something, and he said, well, she can diffuse situations. She's really good at communication, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was and that was a male field training officer. I was in the third month of the program. And we had, you know, every month you have to sit with your lieutenant. And so it's me and my field training officer, and the lieutenant was talking to the field training officer, not even talking to me. And he looked at him and he said, yeah, she's doing, I'm looking at her numbers here. I'm looking at the evaluations and it looks like she's doing good, but have you gotten her into a fight yet? And I was sitting there and I thought, first of all, I'm right here, you know, like he's talking around me. And second of all, this is a moment again, where the mentors and especially the men, because they are the gatekeepers of this male dominated profession. And when they open that gate, oh man, I mean, amazing things happen. And this is what he said. He said, well, LT, he said, I have watched this woman talk people into handcuffs on a skill level that I have never seen before. So has she gotten into a fight? No, I haven't witnessed that, but I've watched her talk everyone into handcuffs. And isn't that what we want? And in that moment, I could have jumped out of my chair and just hugged that man, because I thought, that's an advocate, you know, and the lieutenant just went, and, you know, kind of turned the page. And in that moment, I thought, all right, we're doing okay.
Yeah, great. So talking about mentors, can we talk about mentors and tormentors in your life?
Yes. Oh my gosh. That's a whole other, like, that's the 5-hour podcast, but you know, this is the truth of the matter. Every single one of us has people in our life. I've mentioned, you know, the reason that I've attained the success that I have has been because of mentors, people who have looked at me and said, I see something in you, you know, you would be a great sergeant. And I'm like, wait, are you talking to me? And again, there were no females of rank. And so these were all men. And those men, just like my FTO, who wasn't a sergeant, but he was a field training officer. So this is also the concept of everyone is a leader and everyone can be a disruptor. And I have had so many great mentors, but in the same token, I have had many tormentors, those who have tried to block my path. And it was always very interesting is I didn't really incur many of them when I was a patrol officer, but it was when I started, you know, testing for sergeant, then you become a threat. And so then it became, well, we don't want females. And I remember having one sergeant look at me and he said, you know, if we have to have females in rank, if we have to promote them to sergeant, you know, one of them might as well be you. And I thought, oh my God, was that a compliment or was that a slap? I can't tell. But basically, we're being forced to put females in rank. So, you know, it might as well be you. But, you know, and that wasn't even really a tormentor. That was just someone who was just ignorant. But then throughout my career, I had a lieutenant tormentor, I had commander tormentors, and people who genuinely, purposefully, deliberately, willfully tried to block my path. And those were the days that, you know, I found the most trying in my career.
Mm-hmm. So with that being said, let's talk about your resiliency, because there are challenges that, you know, you've experienced, and I'm sure many women in state, local, federal law enforcement have experienced, are experiencing, and will continue to experience, because those type of men are not going away, unfortunately, mm-hmm. right? And that type of mentality, there comes the culture shift. Yeah. But how did you, your resiliency, how did you handle mm-hmm. those situations?
I'll give you probably the best example of when it finally snapped in me, and where that resilience was inside me that I didn't even realize it, and where I could tap into that reservoir of fearlessness. And I was 5 years as a sergeant, and again, there had never been a female in the rank of lieutenant in the history of my police department. And so I started asking all the guys, all the other sergeants, you know, I was like, hey, are you taking the lieutenant's test? And do you know that 100% of the men were like, heck yeah. And some of them, you know, can't even speak in complete sentences. And yet they were so confident of their ability, right? And here's me, sergeant for 5 years. I'd, you know, gone back to school. I mean, I had checked all the boxes. I was doing a good job. And yet I was still doubting myself. And I decided, you know what, I'm going to do it. I'm going to sign up for the lieutenant's exam. And I did just that. I got called into my commander's office on an unrelated topic later that afternoon. And it was something very simple. He looked at my annual evaluations that I'd written on my officers and my squad. And he said, I don't like your evals. He said, they're too cheerleady. And, you know, I thought, well, that's interesting. And what he meant by that was I gave a lot of positive, you know, complimentary evaluations on the front end of each evaluation. I tried to identify the strengths and skills of the officers. And then, you know, I said, well, Commander, if you turn to the back, you'll see that there's areas of improvement. And he looked at me and he said, you into that empowerment thing, aren't you? And I said, actually, yes, I would like to empower people. That's kind of the premise of a leader, is to empower their people. And, you know, and so I explained to him that, you know, I wanted these officers to feel good about their talent and their skills, but also understand that criticism and feedback, you know, come from a sincere place of caring, of wanting you to get, you know, here when you're here, and, you know, and elevating you. And so I explained all that to him, and he leaned in and he looked me square in the eyes, and he said, did you sign up for the lieutenant's test? And I said, yes, actually I did. I just signed up this morning. And he said, you will never become a lieutenant in this police department if I have anything to say about it. And I remember sitting in that chair in that man's office, and you guys know how it is. I could feel the tears. I was so mad, but I could feel my eyes welling with tears. And so I thought, I am not going to let this man see me break down. And so I bit my lip and, you know, tasted blood. And I just said, is that it? And he said, yep. And I got up and I got into my car and I went into the ugly cry, the kind of cry that people stare at you at stoplights. And I drove home, and on the way home, I said to myself, he's right. I'm not going to take the test. He's right. He's going to keep me down. I don't know what I was thinking, trying, you know, to elevate, you know, to another rank. And it was a stupid thing to do. And then, you know, on the way home, and this is why I say to every single person who is listening, you have to be your own disruptor, because those tormentors will get in your head and their voice will override your sense and sensibility and your logic and your confidence. And you'll start to believe what they say if you're not careful. Not only that, but it's our own voices that do that to us. Our little voices inside our heads are little assholes, because they know our weaknesses, you know, and they know everything that we're afraid of. And so it's ironic, it's paradoxical that even that same voice that we do to ourselves. Mm-hmm. And I remember on the way home going, wait a minute, why am I letting this guy tell me no? Why am I letting him dictate my career? Why am I going to bow down? And I got home and I bought all of the books for the promotional exam. And I read those books and they were so boring. And every time I got tired and wanted to put them down, his face would flash inside my head. And I went, oh, hell no. And I kept reading. I read the books once and then I read the books again. And then I dictated the books a third time onto a tape recorder. And I played that tape back in the shower, on the treadmill, in the car, everywhere I went. I scored number one on that lieutenant's exam, and I became the first female to ever reach the rank of lieutenant in my police department. And the lesson is for everyone is this. It is this. Pay very close attention. When you learn to use criticism as fuel, you will never run out of energy. And that's where my resilience came from. It was proving them wrong. Is you're going to tell me that I can't and that I will never become a lieutenant, then I'm at that fueled me. And it just gave me so much fire to keep going. And that has been the lesson. And that's a gift that man gave me, because every time someone tells me I can't do something or they doubt my skill and ability, I just set out to prove them wrong.
Wow. Thanks for sharing that phenomenal story. It's just, yeah, I'm sure he's listening. Splash.
moving into, and then I became a commander after that, and moving into the office near him was one of the best days of my life.
Oh, I'm sure. Wow. Mm. What a personal satisfaction.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah. I made it and I'm right here.
Yeah, that's right.
So we talked about men, but there are women also that sabotage us, yeah, right?
For sure.
And I love a statement that you made on your book, and I'm going to quote it. And everybody that's listening, you guys got to buy this book. But Kristen said, if I saw a woman doing something that would be harmful to herself or her career, I would offer her gentle redirection. I would help to straighten her crown. Mm-hmm. And that is, I mean, it's just, it made such an impression on me. I love it. That's, I always say, if you're going to look down on someone, look because you're handing down your hand to help them up, right?
Yeah.
And it's in this world of male domination and in policing, mm-hmm, right? Law enforcement, we should be there for each other, yeah, not to compare, not to be, I'm a threat. It's to empower each other. If you can't make it because perhaps I lack a certain skill, I don't have the aptitude for whatever job it is, but my next door person, my agent that sits in the cubicle next to me can put in for it, mm-hmm, go for it. Like, help her get right. You know, empower her and tell her that she can do it instead of, you know, bringing her down. So that was something that it's in your book and I just loved it. Like, literally loved it. I'm going to put it in a quote and tell my daughter about that. So along with the sabotage theme, let's talk about Karen. So when you start reading about Karen, like in your head, you're picturing somebody that's somebody that wants to sabotage you until you really get to know her story. Mm. And, you know, she made a pathway for you and all other women, right?
Yeah.
And there are women that have come before us that have suffered worse than us in this male-dominated world because they really didn't have anybody to turn to.
That's right. Yeah. Let me tell you about Karen. So it requires me to go backwards in time. As I mentioned, my father was a police officer. And so I was a little kid in, you know, the 80s and late 70s. And there was this female police officer that came on with my dad in like 1972, 73, which is the year I was born. And I would see her, you know, driving around our city. And I would say to my dad, like, who's that lady police officer? And he's like, that's Karen. And I was enamored by her. She had just as much influence on me, even though I didn't know her very well, but I just saw her. And that's where that visibility matters, right? So I would see her driving around. I'd be like, Daddy, there she is again. And then fast forward to, I get hired at the police department as a cadet. And then, lo and behold, I get sworn in at the tender age of 21. And I get back from the academy and I get my field training list. And they are three field training officers, and one of them is her. And I was over the moon. I thought, oh my gosh, I get to ride with the person. I get to learn from the person that from when I was a little girl that I have looked up to. And I got in that car with her and she did not speak to me. I was like, okay. So I thought, well, maybe week one, because this was now my second month. And first month I was with my male FTO and he was so chatty. He took me home to dinner, you know, and we would, you know, hang out with his wife and he was just so personable and, you know, training me at the same time. She did not speak to me. But she was, unless it was, you know, hey, here's this general order, here's this. And unless she was teaching me, but we had no conversation. So the first week I thought, okay, well, maybe she's just all business, you know, and that, you know, I've got to earn it. And so I kept doing great. And every morning we were on day shift and every morning she would drive to her house. We had a little break and she would tell me to study my map book, stay in the car, study your map book or write a report. And she would go in and stop in her house and she would get coffee and she would come back out with coffee. And I was like, oh my God, like I wanted nothing more than a cup of coffee, you know? But I was like, okay, no problem. So now week two, same thing. I thought, okay, she'll ease up a little bit. I'm still doing good. And week two, she still didn't speak to me. We go to her house and she leaves me in the car. She doesn't speak to me at all. And then I noticed that she was so nice to the other officers and the male officers. And I was like, okay, it's me. So on the last day of week three, my numbers were great across the board. And she left me in the car again and she got back in and I did what no recruit should do. And I completely blew up on her. And I just said, what did I do to you? Like, why don't you speak to me? Obviously you hate me. Can you just tell me what I've done wrong so I can apologize to you? And she looked at me and she said, drive. And I'm like, okay. And so I drove, you know, and she's like, go up there. And so we sat in this elevated place in our city. And she said, I'm going to tell you a story. And I said, I'm listening because I'm just pissed. And she said, I started here in, let's say, you know, 1973. And she said, I went to the academy. And she said, all of the men at the academy would sit together. And I sat by myself at a really, really long table. And she said, no one spoke to me and I was ostracized. I was ridiculed. And I got back from the academy and I was on patrol and the male officers would stick sanitary napkins to my squad car and they wouldn't back me up. And she said, and then fast forward to 1991, you walked in this police department. She goes, you're bubbly and you didn't have any problem. And she said, and I resented you. And she said, and I didn't even realize what I was doing. And she was in tears when she was telling me the story of what happened to her. And I love that. It's not what's wrong with you, but what happened to you, right? There's the thing behind the thing. I always say that. What's the thing behind the thing? And I was in tears listening to this. Here's what she didn't realize and what I was able to tell her in that moment. I said, I don't even think you can see or understand the way I see you. I said, I wish you could see yourself through my eyes because you're the reason, one of the reasons aside from my dad that I wanted to become a police officer because I saw you doing it. And I said, I was so excited when you were my field training officer. And I said, you went to uncharted territory. You had to basically hack your way to pave this path. And you did it for me. I said, the reason that I got to walk in here in 1991 and I didn't have to hack that path is because you'd already done it for me. And I got to walk a smoother path because of you. And by this time, we're both in tears. And, you know, and it was just this unloading and realizing that she was resenting me for no good reason and me listening to her story. And the way that story ends is actually really sad. She became the first female to ever attain the rank of sergeant in my police department. And I was so proud watching her get that star pinned to her by her husband. And she then was diagnosed with breast cancer very shortly after, and she is no longer with us. She died. And I don't know. I'm not medical, but I'm spiritual. And, you know, I have to think that all of that that stress that, you know, just, you know, ate her body from the inside out, you know, and that's how her story ended. But that's long-winded, but it just taught me that, you know, you have to ask, you know, hey, what's your story? And I'm glad I didn't remain silent. I'm kind of glad I blew up on that day, even though it was probably not the smartest thing to do.
Thanks, Krista. No, it goes back again to communication, right? And that's at all levels, personal relationships with your children, of course, at work. It's just imperative to have that open conversation to find out what's going on with you. What happened to you? Why are you? And we sometimes jump into assumptions, right? Yeah. And that is sometimes detrimental, like I said, to relationships, husbands, wives, couples, etc. in family and at work.
Yeah. And it's not condoning. You can't condone the way she treated me. That's not what that is. But what it is an understanding of, and then a breakthrough, you know, is like, why are you treating me that way? You know, and sometimes when you just lean in and ask the question, you know, well, you know, talk to me, you know, and then you uncover or peel away those, you know, those onion layers. And that's, you know, ultimately what happened. So it's not, I'm not excusing her behavior, but man, once you hear her story, and you hear it, and from her vantage point, of course she resented me. You know, here I was walking in like I owned the place, you know, and, you know, after all that strife that she'd gone through, it was no wonder that she was resentful.
Yeah. So Kristen, become a lieutenant, then a commander. What motivated you to keep rising through the ranks?
Sadly, is a lot of because I looked at leaders and I thought I could do that. I could do better. I learned so much by really delving into what not to do. But, you know, that wasn't necessarily the case when I was a commander. I had a great chief. But what ultimately happened in that moment, it was, I shouldn't say in that moment, what happened over an evolution was confidence was gained. You know, in that moment when I was trying to decide whether I should take the lieutenant's test, I wasn't confident. You know, I wasn't like the guys that are like, heck yeah, I'm taking it. You know, I was like, oh gosh, I have to check every box. But then I started to become more confident in my skills. And I started to realize that through all my academia and then going to the FBI Academy, putting myself through every training class I could, you know, going to management level classes, that I'm like, you know, I'm actually kind of good at this job, you know? And so it was that it shifted, that lack of confidence really morphed into the confidence in my skill and my ability. And I just continued to earn it. And so by that time, by the time I was a commander, I knew I was going to be a chief. I didn't know I was going to be a chief in my department. Sometimes you have to move out to move up. And again, I had a great chief. I'll call him out, Chief Greg Thomas. He's the one that, one of the ones who saw something in me that I didn't. And he is a remarkable man. But I knew that this is what I wanted to do. And then the timing just, you know, worked. He said, I'm going to retire. And the mayor, you know, asked for, you know, applicants. And the mayor would later tell me that, you know, he was going to always choose me, but it was then my resume. You know, he said, you left everyone in the dust. And so I think that's the lesson, that if you want to extrapolate the lesson from this is, you know, is be so busy bettering yourself. Don't compete against anyone. I didn't compete against those other guys. You know, I couldn't. It would be like comparing apples and mangoes. You know, we're different. So compete against one person. And that's when people say, what advice do you give to women in law enforcement? It's this. You are in charge of your own career. Sometimes we do that thing called learned helplessness, you know, or victimization, where we're like, you know, I can never get ahead. I can never do anything. Well, I'll tell you what I did is I just kept competing against myself. I'm going to do this thing and then I'm going to do it better next year. And ultimately what happens is that everybody else is in the rearview mirror. When you're so busy bettering yourself and not looking at your competition from left or right, you're just getting better as you go along. And then when my mayor said, man, you know, you put everybody in the dust, you know, I thought, okay, all right. And so I felt like I had earned it and I felt proud to have been given that position.
Yeah. Thanks. Absolutely. Work on yourself, human capital. It's you, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So talking about that, you went to the FBI Academy and you had some courses or a course at Harvard. Mm-hmm. How did those two help you grow as a leader?
Very different. Very different. So, you know, the FBI Academy was the 10-week program and I learned a lot there, but from there, it was a lot of networking and learning from people in the industry. Harvard and subsequently my second master's degree, which is from the Naval Postgraduate School, immersed me into a field of people that were not all cops. And we in law enforcement have a tendency to think that we are the center of the universe. And as it turns out, we're not. And so being in Harvard was like this petri dish of humans that were elected officials, HR directors, you know, division heads. And so it was state and local government officials, but they were, you know, from all, you know, all positions, leadership positions within a city and municipality. And I learned so much by just listening to different perspectives, as we talked about earlier, that diversity of thought. And I think that is what also helped me, you know, is getting the chief's job and having, you know, that openness to, okay, here's how I think about something. But you have a completely different approach, a different thought process, even a different opinion. Tell me why, how you got there, and help me learn from that. And that's what I think developed my my ability for complex problem solving, was to be able to lean into other people and go, what do you think? And so it was most certainly Harvard and the Naval Postgraduate School that catapulted me to another level, just based on the rigor of academia and calling on other individuals that are smarter than I am.
So when I was at the FBI Academy, I saw a lot of the law enforcement members that were going through the National Academy, and they always looked happy, and they would run into me and talk to me about what I did. And they was like, oh, I'm an FBI instructor. And then they would tell me about their instructors at the National Academy and their experience. So I know it's a great academy, of course, aiming to supplement what you already have, your background. So you are a police chief, you crash through the brass ceiling, as you put it in your book, but there's a riot, right? There's a shootout, an active shooting event that you describe in chapter one, and you go out to the field, like we would say in the bureau. You go out to the streets, you go out, you're in the field with your officers as they're getting shot.
Yeah.
As a leader, that's something that we don't really see. You know, they stay back at the command post or something, but you were out there on the street. What prompted you to do that?
No. So I was not in the gunfire. That is it, to be very clear. I actually did have to go run the command post. But what ultimately happened was, you know, this is the unthinkable, the thing that you never think is going to happen, you know, in your city. And we had prepared for it, thankfully. And the day came when we heard over the radio there was an active shooter. And myself and two other commanders jumped into a car. And as we were en route to the scene, which took us only 4 minutes to get there, that's when I started hearing over the air that one officer was shot. They're pursuing they're trying to find the active shooter. And then another officer was shot. And then I had five officers shot altogether. And we actually had to fight the urge to go to the scene, because this is how we're programmed. You know, every active shooter training event is you run towards the gunfire. And it was actually it was a commander that said, wait a minute, you know, he kind of snapped us out of it. He's like, we've got to go manage this scene. And so we actually had to go. I had a different role. And this is why the department performed so well that day. Most of the officers, they're the heroes. But we all fell into the position, you know, to do the job that we had to do. So I had to go be the incident commander of the mass shooting, the active shooter event. And then there was the lieutenant who was the SWAT commander. And he assumed, you know, incident command for the inner perimeter, and we had to communicate, and I had to manage all the resources coming in. And so I had a very different role that day. So yeah, please don't give me more credit, because I was not in the middle of that gunfire. I actually had to go fulfill the role, you know, that a chief has to do. You have to go manage everything else. And so they're the real heroes of that story, of those first responders that showed up, continue to take gunfire, mm-hmm. and then ultimately located and neutralized the shooter. So five people were killed that day, and five of my officers were shot. Thankfully, those five officers survived, but we still feel the void from those five individuals who were killed that day in that workplace mass shooting.
Yeah, absolutely. A complete tragedy. It's just awful. So you mentioned something about resources, and that's going to bring me to the topic of defunding the police, right? Which you also mm-hmm. talk about in your book. And you actually explain what it means to defund the police, because a lot of people think there's no salaries for police officers and they're disbanded. That's not what it means. So can we talk just a little bit about that?
Yeah, I, you know, after the murder of George Floyd, you know, that was the, you know, defund, abolish the police. And I remember thinking in that moment that whoever came up with that motto is either an idiot or a genius. And the reason I say that is because we've been asking for that for years, you know, and here's what I mean by that. You know, when you say defund the police, don't take police officers away from me because, you know, that's, you know, that comprises 90% of the budget, you know, are humans, but we're having to train, you know, mental health issues, issues that are, you know, that are not criminal, homelessness, drug abuse, you know, mental health, all of the things. And so we have to have crisis intervention. And now you're telling me that you want to take those things away from us so we don't have to respond to mental health incidents, that we don't have to respond to homelessness, that we, you know, you want to defund that so we don't have to do that. And I'm like, we've been asking that for years, is let the social service agencies do that. But instead, no one has stepped up. So it's fallen on our shoulders. So we've had to use our budget to train. So I said, my gosh, if you want to defund us, go right ahead. Don't take my cops, but go ahead. If you want to handle all those. But then you saw what happened is there were certain cities, and I won't name them, that said, we are defunding and abolishing the police. And what happened? You know, it was absolute chaos because without law enforcement, you know, this is where the democracy will crumble, you know, because people left to their own devices will burn it down. And as it turns out, that's exactly what happened. And then the minute you take us away from, let's say, responding to a mental health call for someone who's mentally, you know, in incurring a crisis. Listen, if you want to send a social worker in and they can talk them down, that's precisely what we want. We don't want any part of that. But the problem is that people in crisis often turn violent. They often will, you know, get a weapon and they will try to harm people in the process. So the first time a social worker goes and gets hurt, you're going to blame the police and say, why weren't you there? So we can't win. And so that's why, you know, I broke down that whole defunding the police is like, listen, let's have a hybrid model. You know, let's put more resources towards mental health and wellness and responding to those crises and to homelessness and all of the things that ail us.
Mm-hmm. No, thanks, Kristen. So just a couple more things. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure if the stats are correct, but this is based on the internet, which should we trust it or not? But as of September 30th, there were 3,895 chiefs of police in the United States. Women making only 8.3% of that number. So my question to you is, why do you think police women remain underrepresented at the leadership level? And how can we change that?
Did you say there's
8.3%?
Okay, so the last, oh my gosh, that's way higher than what it was. I thought it was less than 3% that of female chiefs. So okay, that's interesting. I'll have to check that that resource and use it.
That's according to Zipia.com, so it might be completely wrong.
Yeah, I would challenge that. I think it's less than 3%, last that I heard. And that was just at a female leadership conference that I was just at. But listen, here's what, you know, that still, it doesn't matter. There's still so many fewer. That's a great question. It's a great question. And if I knew the answer, I would bottle it up and, you know, sell it, I guess. But I would say that there's probably lots of reasons. You know, one is you're drawing from a pool of only 12% in our profession. So if you only have 12% of women in law enforcement, well, then the natural consequence, you know, just by sheer probability, you know, and percentage is that you're going to have less that reach the rank of, you know, of the CEO of the organization. So I think the question, you know, is, well, and then I'll, you know, say that there's also, you know, people battling stereotypes of like putting a woman in charge, you know, people, you know, might not think that she's a capable leader because, you know, and this has been my plight throughout my entire career is, you know, when I was made it to the finalists for the Chicago superintendent, someone from who was interviewing me said, you're so little, how can you even lead those officers, those men officers? And I thought, Once again, what an ignorant thing to say, you know? So there's that stereotype that probably keeps women from attaining those positions, you know, is that you believe that they can't lead just based on, you know, perception, false perception. But I would say more importantly, you have to go backwards and you have to ask, why aren't women coming into our profession? So we can draw, you know, have a bigger pool from which to draw police executives. And the answer to that are so many different things. Police work is typically working terrible shifts and days off and every single holiday, you know, and I have a lot of women that I talk to and ask, hey, why don't you want to promote? And their answer to me is because I would have to go to 3 to 11 with Tuesdays and Wednesdays off, or I'd have to go to midnight shift and I can't, I've got two kids and I can't be gone from 3 to 11, you know, and that makes sense to me, you know, and we've gotten a lot better as far as balance of gender, where I see a lot more dads stepping up to be great partners, mm-hmm. In parenting, you know, and saying, hey, you know, it's your turn, you go, you know, pursue your dream. And so I love seeing that. And there's so many great men out there that are great, great partners. And I always tell women, as a sidebar, the number one business decision you will ever make, the most important business decision you will ever make in your life is who you choose as a partner, and make sure it's someone who looks at your dreams and, you know, and make sure that they help you attain those as well. But that's the number one reason, is that women still typically notoriously are in charge of, you know, taking care of the kids. And that's why women tell me that they don't want to promote. And if you don't promote to sergeant, you can't promote to lieutenant, captain, commander, and so on.
Yeah. So talking about recruitment, let's chat really quick about 30 by 30.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think the way it's set up now, with all the things that you mentioned, like all the potential obstacles that women will see, is that 30 by 30 most likely going to be ineffective because things need to change culturally first?
I love the 30 by 30 initiative. I really do. I love it because what that means to me is that, you know, when you've got a commitment from a police department that says we are going to fill, you know, 30%, you know, attain that 30% level by 2030, I love that. I think it's a lofty goal, because I'm hoping what that means is that they're going to purposely and deliberately recruit, you know, and to make recruitment videos that show women, as I mentioned, the visibility. When, you know, when you see these recruitment commercials and videos, it's like you see guys kicking down the doors. And I love the departments that showcase, hey, here is Officer, you know, X, and she's a mother and she's a wife, and, you know, here, and she's a dog handler, you know, for our department. Then you can look at that and go, oh my gosh, I'm a mother and a wife and I could be that. And so it's the recruiting. But I absolutely do not support, and I would say this to anyone, I would never want you to put me in a position just to check a box, right? I want competency. I believe that, you know, the best, you know, individual should be placed in that position. Now, I will say, I think, you know, females, you know, are some of the best to be put in these positions, but they have to want the job first. And so I think we need to spend more, instead of making promises, you know, that we will have, you know, 30 by 30, you know, I think we start putting, you know, action behind that, and we deliberately recruit and reach out and find, you know, great women and talk them into coming into our profession.
So it's recruitment and retention, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because if they get recruited and they fail or they leave, then there's no point of the 30 by 30.
Yeah.
So thanks, Kristen. So I also wanted to give a shout out to your podcast, the Hollow Bunny Leadership Podcast, right?
Yes, it's kind of an unorthodox title. And I'll tell you how it came about is because, you know, my co-host, Chief Sylvia Moyer, and I, we were talking on the phone one day, we were dishing, and we were talking about an individual, you know, in a high ranking position, you know, and a well-known chief. And this person is kind of an empty suit, right? And so Sylvia said, oh yeah, that person is a hollow bunny. And I was like, what's a hollow bunny? And she's like, someone with no substance. It's like they have the title, you know, but they really don't have the competency to back it up. And I thought that was so funny, a hollow bunny. And so then we just started talking. We're like, would that be fun to launch a podcast and just like, you know, somebody could be, you know, a bug and, you know, on the wall listening to us just talk about life and leadership and lessons learned and failures and successes. And that's literally how it was launched. And so we always have to explain to people. And Sylvia always says, you know, like, you know, a hollow bunny, how on Easter, like you get this really beautiful foil package. The little bunny has got a bow tie and you rip the foil off and then you bite into the bunny and it's hollow and it's kind of a letdown. And I'm like, that is just, it's so brilliant. And she's like, and that's, you know, so that's what we try to talk about is filling each other's bunnies with substance and how we fill each other, you know? And so that's how the podcast was born. And it's a lot of fun.
I love that. So listeners, if you want to listen to something else besides Badass in Heels, the Hollow Bunny Leadership Podcast. Just love it. Kristen, thank you so much for being on my show today. I truly appreciate you.
Buy the book. Here it is. Reimagine in Blue.
I love it. Love it. I love your website too.
Thank you. Buy my book. You don't have to read it. Just kidding. Read it.
So maybe one day I'll be down in your neck of the woods and you can sign it for me.
Heck yeah, if you're ever in South Florida. Well, thank you. I'm not exactly wearing heels, but, you know, I'm still a badass. But, you know, I appreciate you having me on and thank you for what you do to spread the message to women in law enforcement. It's absolutely remarkable. So thank you so much for your service as well.
Thanks, Kristen.
You just heard from retired Chief of Police Kristen Seaman, the first woman to achieve this rank in the Aurora Police Department in Illinois. How cool is she? A legacy officer who was motivated by seeing her father in action and by seeing a woman, Karen, patrol the streets. She talked to us about resilience, representation, drive to succeed, evolving confidence and self-awareness, empowerment, the 30 by 30 initiative, and she showed us how a true leader leads. I hope you enjoyed her story. Thanks for your support. And make sure to tune in for episode 22.